20-1350, Zaxcom versus Electrosonics. Mr. Greenspoon, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The Court has two pathways toward reversal in the first case this morning, 1305. The first is claim construction, because if Zaxcom is right that the original claims do not embrace mere multi-track recording, then the Board's patentability conclusion on the substitute claims applies, and the Court may reverse based on that. But today I'm going to focus my remarks.
It looks like the Board did a very thorough job here. It distinguished between claims that were not limited to dropout, and hence it concluded did not have a nexus with long-felt need and industry praise, and claims that were limited to dropout and hence were entitled to a nexus. Why don't we respect that and consider they did a sound job in making distinctions?
Well, I'm with you, Judge Lurie, up to the point where maybe there's an assumption that the claim construction was correct. If our claim construction is correct, that the original claims are limited to dropout repair, then we get the benefit of all the substitute claim analysis. That's our contention. So, and that particular argument has to do with English grammar. It's fully briefed. The thing on the right-hand side of the compare or of the combined and the thing on the left-hand side of the combined have to come from the same audio. That's our contention. But today, Your Honors, I'd like to focus on the other pathway for reversal.
And can I just understand, when you mean by from the same audio, you mean from the same local audio device pickup of sound?
That's right, Your Honor. We call it the same sound waves in the briefing here and below.
English language linking argument to come to that conclusion that it has to be just the sound that I'm getting, not the sound that you're getting, that then gets combined with the sound that I already sent to the remote recorder?
Sure. It really is the ligatures and connections in the claim, what I call patentees, which is on one side of the word combined at the end of the claim, you have local audio data. On the other side of the combined word at the end of the claim, you have remotely recorded audio data. And then if you trace those antecedent bases upward into the claim, they both source from the language in the preamble, locally generated audio. And it would take some time to sort of walk through each and every ligature, of course. So if I may, Your Honor, proceed. So assume the Board's construction was right, that Zaxcom doesn't get the benefit of this narrowing for the original claims. But Zaxcom then wins for claims 1 through 11 based on the error in the no nexus finding. And nexus based on industry praise, Your Honors, is binary towards law. It is either there or it is not. And if it is, all of the weighing happens against an obviousness theory later in the analysis. So the question for nexus is whether the objective evidence is, quote, reasonably commensurate with the scope of the claims. And under this standard...
Let's look at the meaning of the claim. This is in a wherein clause. Is that simply a result, or is it a structural step in the method?
Wherein is different from whereby. Wherein is defining structure or defining functions or features in the claim. So whereby would be a different case entirely, but wherein is...
You're saying it's a step. It's a method claim, so there isn't structure, is there?
Well, there's a method claim 12 and then apparatus claim 1. I mean, either way you look at it, the wherein clause at the end is further definitional for whatever the is going on in the claim. But back to nexus, Your Honors, this case has Apex Award industry praise. The Board called it strong when addressing the substitute claims. You've seen the Technical Achievement Award from the Motion Picture Academy. That's the Oscar. You've seen the Technology and Engineering Award from the Television Academy. That's the Emmy. The main point on appeal, Your Honors, is that these awards were not for advertising. They were not for workmanship. They were not for ornament. They were technology awards. And they're from Zaxcom's peers and competitors praising the 900 series design.
Can I just ask you this? My assumptions may not be right, but why doesn't it in fact matter a very great deal if you're wrong about the claim construction and the board is right about the claim construction? So assume you have a claim that covers embodiments A and B, and there's lots of praise for B. Why does that automatically tell you that a claim, or not automatically tell you, why does that justify a presumption of nexus for a claim that covers A, for which there's no praise at all?
Well, that, the short answer, Judge, is that's not our case, because we have the Emmy materials at 4272 and 40, well, that's Oscar. Emmy is 4304, which calls out that it's, quote, not for a single component but for the system as a whole. So system
right,
as a whole.
Right, but if the claim covers sort of standard variety multi-tracking, taking a bunch of different local records and putting them on parallel track, and there's no praise for that, then why should that praise for something else affect the obvious analysis of something that is by claim construction within the claim?
It perhaps might, Your Honor. At the rebuttal stage of the analysis of nexus and presumptions of nexus, but here we're at the presumption stage. You know, this is the short path that the law offers the patentee, where you, what you show is that the claim is an embodiment, or the product is an embodiment of the product was praised. The one exception, which I'm sure we'll discuss today, is coextensiveness. But coextensiveness is a situation where the claim coverage is for a, quote, small component. That's the Henny Penny case. If the claim coverage is for a small component, then you don't get the presumption of nexus. But if the claim is for the whole system, you do. That's very clear in the case law, particularly Henny Penny. So back to the awards, Your Honor, and the praise. Last Friday's decision in Quanergy Systems shows that Zaxcom did all it needed to do to get the presumption. And the evidence showed that the 307 patent covers the 900 series system. No one disputes that on appeal. And if we get into questions of coextensiveness, the result is the same, because the claim coverage is for a whole system. The praise, especially 4304 of the appendix, talks about the whole system. And certainly, you know, it's certainly correct that there are call-outs of additional things. But that's when I get to go to the Fox Factory analysis, Your Honor. And let's say Fox Factory is good law. I'm assuming that for my argument today. In the Fox Factory analysis, the coextensiveness limitation or exception is expanded somewhat to also exclude the benefit of critical unclaimed features that have a material impact on the functioning of the system. So let's break that down. Critical unclaimed features. There is no argument before the board from Electrosonics that any of the call-outs below where the Emmy materials say it was the whole system that got the award were for quote-unquote critical unclaimed features. There's a second exception that goes, well, not exception, but a second way or pathway for Electra's rebuttal to undermine the presumption that I just talked about. That would be to show that the claimed combination is merely readily known in the prior art, and that won't work either for Electro, because the Rambus case, Rambus v. Ray, 731 F3rd 1257, says that this legal standard requires that the objective evidence to have arisen exclusively from prior art features, and that's impossible because the whole combination is, on this record, undisputedly novel as a combination. And, of course, the future question for analysis is whether it's also obvious, and we contend it's not. So, Your Honors, the board's no on nexus should have been a yes. Again, it's binary, weighing happens later, and the board lacks substantial evidence for its no nexus finding. In view of at least the award materials showing that the whole system earned ZaxCom its apex awards. But the board did get it right to call the objective evidence strong when it studied it, and that's why this court should reverse on the original claims. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
We will do that, Mr. Bell.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the court, Corey Bell for Cross Appellant Microsonics. I'll start with Nexus, where we just left off. In particular, their 28J letter. They make this claim that in the proceedings before, they did the exact same analysis, where they had their expert directly map the product to the claims. But we can look directly at the only Nexus analysis that was presented by ZaxCom below, and that's at APPX 396. And all that does is have a statement that there is a strong nexus between the objective indica and the issued and substitute claims of the 307 patent, including those that were found to be anticipated. Then the expert simply goes on to state the language of the claim with no comparison between the claim language and the evidence. So that's why this is not like the quantity. And our real issue with this case here is what happened after the fact. And this was the board's decision to stand in the patent owner's shoes and make an argument for the first time in its final written decision relating to whether or not there was a nexus relating to the replacing elements of the claims.
Mr. Bell, assuming the claim construction was correct and that it encompasses both multi-track and dropout, that's, in terms of coextensiveness, those are only two embodiments. And so do we not consider a nexus when more than the one embodiment has a nexus? I mean, here there are only two. It's not like you've got a great big broad claim with an unlimited number of embodiments, and only one of them has a nexus. And it's not like, I don't think it's like something is missing or something is really additive. Tell us why there should be no nexus when there are just two embodiments.
Yes, Your Honor. And first, I think there's a clear point to make here, and we did dispute that there was essential features missing. So what ZaxCom was praised for and claimed it was praised for below was having a wireless transmitter with integrated reporting. That is not what the claims require. In fact, the original claim one does not even include a wireless transmitter. That was added in the motion to amend. So all of this discuss of wireless transmission and its benefits there have nothing to do with the original claims. The other issue is what the board was trying to do was trying to help ZaxCom out, because all of the elements that relate to the local recording device was all in the primary reference struct. So the issue is that local recording device had the capability of doing many things. It could be used to doing multi-track. It could be used to do dropout repair. That really wasn't the invention. The invention was having a specific local audio device. And the problem for ZaxCom is that the elements in the claims that relate to that also relate directly to the primary reference. So when we're talking about secondary considerations and concerns of hindsight, there's no hindsight concern because we're not reading anything into the primary reference because it's all there. And then just briefly returning to my issues with what the board did. One, it was wrong for them to stand in patent owner's shoes because it was patent owner's burden to carry it. But also they did this for the first time in the final written decision, so we did not have the opportunity to respond. Additionally, this case was pre-Fox Factory, and the PTO found a presumption of nexus. And their argument for why that's still fine is really interesting to me. The PTO's argument is that this is a harmless error because in two later cases relating to two different patents, claims of different scope, the board reached the same outcome on the same evidence and the same argument. But that's exactly what the court criticized in Fox Factory, is that you shouldn't be looking at the same evidence and the same arguments if you find multiple claims of different scope across different patents, all to be patent eligible over that same evidence. And the issues don't just appear in the nexus analysis. In particular, if we go to long-tail need, which is what the board highlighted as its first evidence of strong nexus, the first step of proving nexus requires that there be a long-felt need based on the date when the problem to be solved was identified and the efforts made to solve that problem. The board reached the conclusion that there was no evidence of the date when the problem to be solved was identified and the efforts were made to solve the problem. So the board concluded that under the legal test, we don't have what we need to reach long-felt need. The PTO's response is that substantial evidence supports the board's conclusion. The problem is if substantial evidence supports the board's conclusion, that supports the finding that there was, in fact, no long-felt need under the legal test. No, Your Honor, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
We will save your time. Ms. Silfen for the PTO.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The parties have well covered the claim construction and factual disputes here. And as the court knows, we believe these intensely factual determinations by the board are supported by substantial evidence. So I just wanted to make a couple of quick points. First, there's been a lot of debate about the burden shifting and nexus framework. And fundamentally, the framework requires exactly what the board did in all three of these cases, which is to see whether the evidence shows a close enough relationship between the claimed novel invention and the praise from the industry. All of this court's cases on nexus emphasize that inquiry depends on the particular facts and circumstances in the case, facts and circumstances that the board here analyzed in depth. Second, many of the cases that the private parties rely on, like Apple versus Samsung, WBIP, Classco, and Brown and Williamson, all wind up affirming the fact finder on secondary considerations, even when they criticize the lower tribunal's burden-shifting framework. The fact-finding in the first instance is the predominant factor. Finally, I just wanted to address the point.
Can I just ask you, I guess I'm a little confused. Am I hearing you incorrectly in saying, never mind all this presumption business, it's all just a question of fact-finding? I mean, that may be a sound way to run the railroad, but it's not really our current way, is it?
No, there's the presumption and burden shifting is important, and I'm not trying to downplay that. And it's about sort of who has to provide evidence at what point. And I think the board addressed that correctly by saying there was, by starting with the presumption analysis and moving on to the nexus analysis. And this court's cases address those sort of, there's a little bit of variation in how the case law addresses which part is the presumption and which part is the ultimate nexus question. On the presumption question, it's clear that it requires that the claims both embody that the product both embody the invention and be coextensive with the invention. That test is in cases like Henny Penny, also the Brown and Williamson case. And I think that makes it clear that the coextensiveness analysis isn't exactly the same thing as the embody analysis or the embody question. So Dexcom is trying to say all it has to do is embody the claimed invention, but the coextensiveness has to do some work too in order to get the presumption. And then the ultimate nexus question depends on sort of how close. There's just a lot of weighing of evidence that is different in every case. So the industry praise is not the same.
Why do you think that the original claims did not meet the coextensive tests and the substitute claims did?
Well, certainly the original claims are broader and cover the multi-track embodiment. And the multi-track embodiment is exactly what is in Strub, right? So you have prior art that does exactly the thing that the claims are broad enough to cover. So you've got, and then when you look at the dropout embodiment, it's different from what the prior art does, and it's the thing that was praised. So the board focused on that as well, right? That the praise was heavily focused on repairing dropouts. So to grant the nexus and find the claims non-obvious when they are broad enough to cover a different embodiment that's in the prior art seems like too big a stretch of the nexus analysis or of the secondary considerations analysis.
Did the board conclude on the original claims that even if there were a presumption that these objective indicia could not outweigh, let's call it the prima facie case of obviousness of the multi-track embodiment and therefore of the claims?
I think that is an accurate way to read the board's opinion. The board did not, so looking at the original claims, in this first case, the board didn't talk about the presumption one way or the other. The board talked about the presumption in context of the amended claims and then talked about it more in the later case after Fox Factory had issued from this court and sort of emphasized the process of the burden shifting analysis. But I think the analysis on the original claims was just that the claims are so broad that they cover something that isn't what was praised and something that was in the prior art.
Thank you, Ms. Silfen. Mr. Greenspoon will give you 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And Judge Toronto, to answer the question you just asked, the board actually gave zero weight to secondary considerations for the obviousness analysis on the original claims. So that's I think, a more complete answer than what you just heard.
And can I just double check something? That the weighing is a matter of law, which we can do.
The final weighing, if you're looking at the Emmy and the Oscar and its program materials, et cetera, and comparing that to the obviousness case, yes, that's an issue of law, not performed by the board for the original claims at all, because they decided to give it a zero instead of a one for the binary nexus finding.
Oscar looks like it has a lot of weight.
they're pretty heavy when you pick them up, Judge. I agree. So, and Your Honors, we're not trying to evade the coextensiveness requirement. I think you might have heard that suggested. For the presumption question and answer, we understand and embrace that there is a coextensiveness analysis baked into that. But the coextensiveness analysis, properly construed under Henny-Penny, Rambus, just a variety of cases, is that if the claim coverage is not the wide outdoors, but is just a tiny small component, then you don't give the presumption. That's the coextensiveness exception when otherwise we've met, you know, the Apple v. Samsung en banc standards, WVIP, et cetera. So moving on, just very quickly, evidence of claim coverage over the 900 series, very surprised to hear that that's an issue today at oral argument. But I would refer Your Honors not only to Appendix 396, which is a patent owner response, but also expert testimony at Appendix 3051 to 52 and the inventor's testimony at 3102 to 03. These all validated, verified claim coverage over the thing that was praised by the various academies. And just a couple final points. With respect, I'm going to call it the irony of ironies that we just heard from Mr. Bell, that the thrust of their cross appeal is the due process notice question. And the reason for that is in the opening red brief, we didn't see anything about this. There's no citation of Magna Tools. It's a fully fleshed out argument in the reply brief. I'll grant him the cross appeal reply, but it's not in the opening brief. And in any case, what's the outcome of his argument, if he were correct about it, is that he gets to put in a fourth brief at the board, in addition to the other three, to say exactly the same things he's saying that he's always said, which is talking about unclaimed features and that the claims just cover the prior art. Finally, very last point, on long-felt need, the board did identify the year 2005 as a hard place to frame its analysis, and then gave it little weight for reasons that are in the record, which we don't need to go into. Thank you again, Your Honors.
Mr. Bell, you have some rebuttal time on the cross-appeal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I still think the key issue for the cross-appeal and secondary considerations is that both the PTO and Mr. Greenspoon ignored that Claim 12 was found to be anticipated, and they argued that the claims and the Emmys and all of these awards were coextensive with an anticipated claim, and that should be case dispositive. Unless Your Honors have anything further, I have nothing.
No, thank you all for your arguments. We will see you soon, and this case is submitted.